On the afternoon of April 18, 1775, a young boy who worked at a livery stable in Boston overheard one British Army officer say to another, "There'll be hell to pay tomorrow." The stable boy ran with the news to Boston's North End, to the home of a silversmith named Paul Revere. Revere listened gravely to the boy. That was not the first rumor to come his way that day. Earlier, he had been told of an unusual number of British officers gathered on Boston's Long Wharf, talking in low tones. British crewmen were spotted scurrying around the boats tethered beneath the HMS Somerset and the HMS Boyne in Boston Harbor. Several other sailors were seen on shore that morning, running what appeared to be last-minute errands. As the afternoon wore on, Revere and his close friend Joseph Warren became more and more convinced that the British were about to make the major move that had long been rumored, to march to the town of Lexington, northwest of Boston, to arrest the colonial leaders John Hancock and Samuel Adams, and then on to the town of Concord to seize the stores of guns and ammunition that some of the local colonial militia had stored there. What happened next has become part of historical legend. At 10 o'clock that night, Warren and Revere met. They decided they had to warn the communities surrounding Boston that the British were on their way so that local militia could be roused to meet them. Revere was spirited across Boston Harbor to the ferry landing at Charleston. He jumped on a horse and began his midnight ride to Lexington. In 2 hours, he covered 13 miles. In every town he passed through along the way, he knocked on doors and spread the word, telling local colonial leaders of the oncoming British and telling them to spread the word to others. Church bells started ringing. Drums started beating. The news spread like a virus as those informed by Paul Revere sent out riders of their own until alarms were going off throughout the entire region. The word was in Andover, 40 miles due north of Boston by 5 a.m., and by 9 in the morning had reached as far away as Ashby, well to the northwest. When the British finally began their march towards Lexington on the morning of the 19th, their foray into the countryside was met, to their utter astonishment, with organized and fierce resistance. In Concord that day, the British were confronted and soundly beaten by the colonial militia, and from that exchange came the war known as the American Revolution. Paul Revere's midnight ride is perhaps the most famous historical example of a word-of-mouth epidemic. A piece of extraordinary news traveled a long distance in a very short time, mobilizing an entire region to arms. Not all word-of-mouth epidemics are this sensational, of course, but it's safe to say that word-of-mouth is, even in this age of mass communications and multi-million-dollar advertising campaigns, still the most important form of human communication. Think for a moment about the last expensive restaurant you ate at, the last expensive piece of clothing you bought, or the last movie you saw. In how many of those cases was your decision about where to spend your money heavily influenced by the recommendation of a friend? Word of mouth, however, remains very mysterious. People pass on all kinds of information to each other all the time, but it's only in the rare instance that such an exchange ignites a word of mouth epidemic. There is a small restaurant in my neighborhood that I love and that I've been telling my friends about for 6 months, but it's still half empty. My endorsement clearly isn't enough to start a word-of-mouth epidemic. Yet there are restaurants that, to my mind, aren't any better than the one in my neighborhood that open and within a matter of weeks are turning customers away. Why do some ideas and trends and messages tip and others don't? In the case of Paul Revere's ride, the answer to this seems easy. Revere was carrying a sensational piece of news. The British are coming. But if you look closely at the events of that evening, that explanation doesn't solve the riddle either. At the same time that Revere began his ride north and west of Boston, a fellow revolutionary, a tanner by the name of William Dawes, set out on the same urgent errand, working his way to Lexington via the town south of Boston. He was carrying the identical message through just as many towns, over just as many miles as Paul Revere. But Dawes's ride didn't set the countryside afire. The local militia leaders weren't alerted. If it were only the news itself that mattered in a word-of-mouth epidemic, Dawes would now be as famous as Paul Revere. He isn't. So why did Revere succeed where Dawes failed? The answer is that the success of any kind of social epidemic is heavily dependent on the involvement of people with a particular and rare set of social gifts. Revere's news tipped, and Dawes didn't, because of the differences between the two men. This is the law of the few. In this section, I'd like to talk about the people critical to social epidemics, about what makes someone like Paul Revere different from someone like William Dawes. These kinds of people are all around us, yet we often fail to give them proper credit for the role they play in our lives. I call them connectors, mavens, and salesmen.